When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Morning.
Morning, Matt. How are we?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Very well. Yeah, anyway, not doing too badly. Can't complain.
I went to Cheltenham Racecourse yesterday. I'm in my wife's good books because I got us, we were invited to hospitality. So, yeah, did that. So that was great fun. And then ended up £8.37 up on the day. So don't have to work out how to spend my winnings later
today. Well, a win's a win. They say the house always wins, but not in your case. That's great.
I went entirely on the fact that I'd gone to interview this jockey called Harry Skelton and his brother Dan Skelton, the trainer, and they're the son of Nick Skelton, the show jumping gold medalist.
Oh, yeah.
And I really liked them, and they were talking about this horse, Langer Dan, which wasn't necessarily the favourite. I think it was fourth or fifth favourite. Anyway, I went for that, and that was our big win of the day.
So did you just immediately stop and say, that's it?
That's exactly what I did, because I was already pretty far behind on the previous races, so that was it. But yeah, so I'm not a glorious gambler. It's pathetic sums, hence the £8, whatever it is up.
Yeah, but a win's a win. Yeah. You know, you've finished on a high. I've never been to Cheltenham. I've been to Ascot, and I got to judge best turned out or best dressed or whatever the horse competition thing, you know, the way the horses are presented. Knew nothing about it, but just standing there next to these incredible creatures, it was they're huge animals as well. You don't get any concept of how big they are when you see them on the TV, but they're just so massive, powerful sprinters, basically. Incredible to watch.
And how are you this week? All okay?
Yeah, doing all right. I'm just cracking on with a few little jobs at home. And nothing exciting what I've got coming up. Track day in the car next week.
Where's that? Oh, Donington, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, just having a bit of fun in that. It's quite a quiet time of year, so good time for doing podcasts.
Are you rubbish, though, when you're quiet? You strike me that you wouldn't be very good at sitting
yeah,
still for too
well,
long.
Yeah, well, when I say quiet, I mean there's still a million jobs at home that you're trying to catch up with, and so busy with that and the kids and everything else.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
Yeah, not in terms of work or anything exciting like going to Cheltenham. That's nothing like that for me at the moment, but yeah, looking forward to this today.
Yeah, well, I think we're joined from sunny Tenerife, it's going to be, but I might have that back. He might be back at home. But we've got the swimmer, Adam Peaty, who's a two-time Olympic gold medalist, multiple world champion, and I think he's got a ludicrous number of the fastest times of all over his distance. Like, he's just sort of in a different league to everyone else.
He's a bit of a legend of his sport already. Yeah, he's still competing, but it's funny though, because you almost feel like he should be getting more, or should have more recognition for what he's achieved. But I think in swimming, he basically got to win about a gazillion medals at every single games to get any recognition. It's because there's so many medals being presented in so many different events that you need to be like a Phelps or whatever. You're going to win, you know, multiple medals. But aside from that, he has specialised and he is untouchable in his chosen event.
It's so impressive to watch, isn't it, when he just pulls away from people who are absolute superstars in their own right. You know, some of the fastest times, if you removed him, they would be there. But he's just so good.
Well, it's sort of reminds you of athletes like Michael Johnson, like Usain Bolt. You know, basically everyone else, when they're in their absolute prime, everyone else is racing for second place. And you know, for so long that's been the case. I think it seems like he's got more of a fight on his hands.
Yeah, it does.
Be fair to say in Paris. Yeah,
I think so, but he seems to switch it on and time it right, and he needs that motivation, I think, to lift him to that other level. So yeah, hopefully he times it right, because it'd be amazing.
Yeah, that's another thing. Maybe we can ask him about it. But usually, to be able to produce these incredible performances, you need a rival. You need somebody who is your Prost to your Senna, the inspiration to make you work hard to bring out these incredible performances. But he seems to have done it all by himself.
I think you would struggle that. You know, that's why he tails off a bit, because there isn't someone that pushes him to, you know, if he's winning by a second or something in a race that's, you know, well under a minute. Anyway, actually, here he is. Shall I let him in?
Let's do it.
He can actually tell us rather than us talking about blind.
That's exactly.
Here we go.
Morning, Hello. Adam. How are we doing?
Morning. How are you doing?
All good. Where are you just now? Are you still in Tenerife?
I am, yeah. I'm still on training camp.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've not had many sports people. This is traditionally it's been for comedians, so there's no pressure. You don't have to be hilarious, but if you've got a few jokes,
don't worry about that then. You know.
But yeah, I think you've met Matt before, haven't you?
Yeah, we've done a few interviews over the years, but things. I was thinking it would be bright blue, sunny skies behind you, but it looks a bit cloudy there today.
Me too, but it's one of those days, I guess.
You're nearly at the end of the camp, aren't you? Are you coming home soon?
Yeah, coming home on Saturday. So, right. Yeah, then we go into Olympic qualifications in a bit weeks in London. So, it'll be good.
In terms of Olympic qualification, is it just purely on that one event? There's no room for reputation or previous performances. It's just down to what you do on the day.
Well, I think the actual discretion on the actual legal bit is that British women have full discretion anyway. Just in case, you know, one of their top athletes was ill, for example, they're not going to get thrown out of that spot, I'm guessing. But also that, yes, we do only have one day. So there's two races, heats and finals, which is going to be, which is I quite like because the pressure is pretty much on. As I'm sure you're aware, you've got no room for error, no room for anything, which is probably the best preparation you could have going into Olympic Games. Instead of a lot of countries may have, oh yeah, we'll do this, but then you still qualify or whatnot. We don't have that room for any error. And it's quite fitting as well. It's in, obviously, London. So, obviously, 2012, it's got a lot of history and a lot of heritage. So, I'm excited.
How horrible is this training camp you've just been doing? Is it one of those nasties? I mean, I don't know how many weeks it's lasted.
It's been a different one. It's been a bit of an experience. I'm sure Chris knows and people listen to this that if you ever train for something for so long, so I've been going, you know, since last summer now, I haven't had a break really, which is been able to get my proper block of work in, aerobic capacity, VO2s, thresholds. And now I'm coming into this work now and we're starting to go down in terms of volume, but where the intensity goes up. So my nervous system pretty much the last 2 days has been literally AWOL. It's been everywhere. Like I get out of the pool and you feel a bit dizzy. And it's only been 4,000 aerobic meters. So your body, I'm going into a bit of rest now. It just handles that very, very differently. The body is an incredible thing, but it's very hard to almost kind of react to because every day is different at the moment. But as we go more and more and progress more, the more it becomes predictable. And hopefully by the time we get to Olympic qualities in 2.5 weeks, we'll be in a good spot. But it has been a hard camp in terms of the intensity, but we are starting to come down now and start to see a bit of light.
So your chosen event, your main event is, in terms of duration, it's just under a minute's worth of effort. Can you kind of explain to people listening what it's like for an event of that duration? Because it's not a pure sprint, but it's not like a paced effort, really. It's can you explain, A, the training behind it and the fact you've got to juggle all these different forms of fitness, all these different components of fitness, but also the pain you go through in 56 seconds?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of strange, actually, because if you ever say go as hard as you can for 56 seconds in any sport, it's going to be pretty tough at full whack. And obviously, swimming, as we know, is arms and legs. Not that other sports aren't, but you've got to equal that power, especially in breaststroke where it's more technical. So the first 50 meters has got to be something we call easy speed. So if we're not hitting that easy speed and we're not hitting we're not getting to that wall kind of with enough to get back, you're done for pretty much. You know, you're going to end up in a really bad place in that last 15 meters. So we want to touch the wall in a place where we're confident. We want to touch the wall and go, okay, I've got something in my back pocket here. Bearing in mind all these decisions are made at half a second, microseconds, but that's why we train for. We have to train for every single decision, everything that can go wrong, everything that can go right. So we visualize a lot of this. But yeah, we've got to make sure that we have got something left for that last 25 meters because that's where the races are technically won and lost. But Mel says to me, my coach, that every single race is won down that on 100 meters down that first 25, because if you spend too much energy in that front end zone, you aren't, doesn't matter how fit you are, doesn't matter if you're the best in the world, you're not coming back because you'll be too tense. So it's really about fluidity, all about using the technique to your advantage and almost maintaining that speed all the way through to that 50 meter, then building that last 50 meters back. So kind of complicated, but very simple, because it is only two lengths of the back, as we say. But yeah, there's a lot of training that goes into that months, if not years, prior to that event.
But in terms of your adrenaline is at high, it's an Olympic final. How do you get that right, that easy speed? Because it would be easy to get that wrong in the moment, despite all the training.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly hard to do. I think once you get to an Olympic final, you've got to almost be on that autopilot. And the adrenaline is kind of basically a byproduct of the arena, byproduct of the actual occasion. I've always loved and seeked adrenaline my whole life. I think it's one of the best highs you can get in life that just doesn't, nothing replaces it really. Not even two beers. but for me, it's, you know, when I'm standing behind the block, I'm like, you know what? This is what I was almost born for. This is what I was made for. I truly believe that. And being able to control that and use that to your advantage. I've had races before where I don't even get tired. I get down to the first 50 meters. I'm like, okay, that was good. I'm ahead. I know I'm ahead. I touch the wall. I'm like, I don't even feel like nothing's touching me here. And I finish, for example, my world record. I finished like I could have kept going. Strange. But I don't let that event and that adrenaline take control of me. I control it. And I seep it out over a course of 56, 57 seconds. But that's where, you know, visualization really comes in. That's where the maturity comes in, I think, as an experienced athlete as well. Because, you know, I spoke to a few athletes about this kind of elusive performance, and some performers just take care of themselves. And you want those performances to take care of themselves at the Olympic Games, but also you only get a few of those in your whole life. So it's picking and choosing and enabling those occasions to be at the right time, because you don't want to do it at the British Championships. You want to do it at Olympic Games, for example.
So is it your fourth Games? You were London, Rio, Tokyo, and then Paris, obviously. How, I mean, things must have changed drastically over those Games in terms of the expectations that you put in yourself, that the expectation from the public. You know, how are you feeling leading into Paris? What's, you know, it's been a tricky few years for you, but it seems as though things are starting to come good at the right time for when it really counts.
Well, I mean, it's my third Game, so I don't know how old I look, Chris. But
were you not in London?
No, I wasn't, no.
Were you not?
I was, Rio was my first one. But I'm, yeah, wow. I mean, it's funny because I watched London, obviously, watch yourself perform and, you know, watch some of the best. And I think London really was like a moment that kind of changed my life. We all talk about, you know, sliding doors or butterfly effect, and seeing people perform in their home Games for their, you know, for their own country, and seeing the passion behind the country that the Games bought. I think I was like, you know what, I want a piece of that pie, but I ain't going for second place. I was a sore loser, still don't like losing, but I've become a little bit more peaceful when I do lose. But, you know, going into Rio, very different experience. Winning the Olympic Games once is incredibly difficult, as we know. Winning it twice, you know, it's 100 times harder. Winning it three times in the same event, when you've got young ones coming through and you've got talent continually refreshing and trying to take you down, you know, the odds are really stacked against you. But then, you know, you've got to develop as a human, you've got to develop as an athlete, and through that whole process, if you stay the same, you'll stagnate and you won't get the results. And I just don't think it's possible to be the same person anyway over the course of 8 years. Why would you want to be? It means you're not being pushed. It means you're not developing as a person. So going into Paris now, I'm very peaceful with where I'm at. And I think the biggest thing you can ever get, you know, from yourself is that you've done everything you possibly can. There's not a stone that's unturned. I've done everything I've been told to do. I've trained like I've always trained, the hardest worker in the room. And that gives you peace. And that means you can go into an Olympic Games and like, you know what? There's nothing more I could have given here. And I know this is incredibly hard to do, but you just want to be hard to beat. That's what it's all about.
I wonder, this is a very basic question, but why are you so good at the discipline? Physiologically, what is it about? Obviously, you work so hard, but is your body designed for breaststroke?
I don't know. I think, I guess there's a certain amount of genetics and talent that lined up perfectly. But also there's a huge amount of hard work that I just love to work hard. I don't wake up in the morning and go, oh, you know, I love comfort. I'm the complete opposite of that. I'm like, I want to challenge myself. I want to go. What can I do differently today? And yes, you know, some days there is like, oh, I wish I had a day off today, but you're not pushing yourself hard enough if you don't have those thoughts, you know? So of course we all want comfort. We all want, you know, a place where we feel safe, a place where we feel relaxed and stuff. But for me, you know, the whole purpose of my life is to continually push boundaries, continually improve so I can choose to be comfortable when I want to be, which is my off season, which is retirement, potentially whenever that is. But yeah, I mean, you have got to be built differently for this, especially for the 19 years that I've been doing it. It's an incredibly long time. It will break you at every single stage that you become challenged. But it's continually saying no and continually finding a way between, you know, starting out and achieving that goal. It's never, ever easy. It's never, ever simple. And, you know, I wouldn't want it to be.
Swimming's one of these sports that's infamous for you start very young ages. You're committing to a fairly disciplined lifestyle at a time in your life where a lot of other kids are just playing, having fun, trying things, doing, you know, they're not experiencing a life that as a swimmer that you were or you are. Was there any room for other sports when you were a kid? Did you try other sports? Was there a chance you could have gone down a different route into something else? Or was it 100% swimming, nothing, you know, laser focus, blinkers on, nothing else was attracting your attention?
I did a little bit of cross country running. I loved a little bit of a sprint. I wasn't that good at it, but I always loved my BMX. I always loved being on a bike. I still road cycle in my off season. I don't do it now because of the risk if someone pulls out on me, as you know. but now it's, you know, when I chose swimming, it was more to do with obviously going through that school kind of system and then choosing the club. And I just loved the feel of the water, but also the work that was required. I kind of wasn't really into any team sports for some reason. I just preferred to be accountable to my own work instead of relying on someone else, which has its, you know, gives and takes. But yeah, until I went mountain biking one day when I was younger and a handlebar went through my leg, and that was the time to say, you know, I'm not really cut out for this.
Yeah, it's high risk.
I still got a scar on my leg, actually.
Have you? So was it the end of the bars? Yeah. Went into your, oh, gee whiz.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like down the rock gardens, I was like, I just stay like this.
It's all good fun until it's not, and that's the trouble with mountain biking. It's like,
exactly, yeah, exactly.
Trees don't move when you hit them, and neither do rocks. But yeah. But yeah. Have you ever gone mountain biking, Matt? I've never asked you that before. Is it anything you've ever tried?
I haven't really. No, I sort of should. My youngest son's super keen on that sort of thing, so I think he'd be well up for it. But yeah, maybe I should do it. I'd probably just damage myself, I would think.
It is high risk, but it's mad what the new bikes that you can get with full suspension. So this is a sign of how old I am. You know, when I started out mountain biking in the early 1990s, they were fully rigid bikes, and then they were flex stems which moved about a centimeter. Then you got forks, but with a hardtail bike in the back. And now you look at the bikes, and it is just like a motorbike without an engine in terms of suspension, and they can just float over these massive big ruts and jumps, which means they go even faster. So that when you do eventually crash, you're going to have a really big one. But yeah. So, I mean, are you now, I guess it's like all professional sport. There's no room for other sports, or in the off season, a few weeks at the end, you play a bit of golf. Do you have any other sports? I mean, I know you're into cars as well, aren't you? You've got any interest in track driving or motorsport or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I love it all. Obviously, you know, being on track as a professional athlete, the insurance is pretty pretty crazy. And it becomes a conversation of risk versus reward. I know that stuff's waiting for me after sport, that, you know, I know the things I enjoy. Off season is just the time to spend with my family, my son, my girlfriend, Holly, and just have time for normality. I'm not chasing like all these other things where I'm like, oh, stimulus, 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 because I have that every single day. So it's a time for me to be really peaceful and really just, one, go on holiday, if I have the time, and two, being able to just, again, live a little bit of a normal life where there's no expectation, you know, to do anything else. And we still got to look after what we eat. We can't just go on, you know, horrendous binges, again, horrendous amount of weight. And I've been doing that, you know, 10 years professionally now. You know, I love gaming on my computer. I love it now that George is getting to an age, nearly four in September. So he's getting to an age where he starts to like Minecraft and Xbox games and stuff. So I really like doing that with him when he's with me. But golf again, I'm like, you know what? I'm 29. I've got the rest of my life to, you know, get into that. Why would I start
to get frustrated by it? Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. I do love my cars. We've done a few things with Cupra, around the content, around track days at Alton and hill climbs and stuff like that. But yeah, I also like my big V8s and my, you know, my fast cars, naturally aspirated. So yeah, I mean, there's so much in life. Yeah. But I guess really you could add all these amazing things, but I'm also a very simple person. I like being in the garden, mowing the grass, for example. Like a petrol lawnmower for me really excites me. Sounds very boring. But I'm like, you know what? This is so cool that petrol is in this lawnmower and it's cutting my grass. It's crazy. I just love those simple things. And, you know, I think that's the key to happiness, where you can find joy in the most mundane or tedious things and still have a purpose. Even in the off season, I think that's where a lot of athletes go. I won't say wrong, because it's not necessarily wrong, but they could use advice of, you don't need to gamble. You don't need to go out every night and get drunk. You don't need to do all these things when you could really have these simple things in life, which give you more wealth in terms of internal wealth.
It's funny you should say that. I'll never forget, in Sydney, in the village, it was towards the end of the 3 weeks or the 2.5 weeks. And there was a group of Aussie swimmers in the dining room, like a big crowd, big gathered round, and there was sort of chanting and clapping. And I thought, what's going on here? Went across, and I said to someone, what's happening? And they said, oh, this guy's he's trying to eat 100 nuggets in one go. I still don't know who it was. It was an Aussie swimmer, and he was a big lad, and he was into the 90s by that point, and then he was pretty unwell, and then he kept going, and he did the 100, and everyone was cheering and clapping. I was just like, I guess for a lot of athletes, it is just the, you know, they will, having lived that monastic lifestyle for so long, for, you know, literally everything they put in their mouth, everything they eat, their rest, their training, everything is prescriptive, it's planned, and it is just a pressure release, and some people do it that way, and other people, as you say, like, I kind of get it as well. I find joy in this, the most mundane things, making a cup of coffee. What little things that you get into that you then want to know more about and kind of explore. And it's, you know, yeah, really boring stuff, which on the surface of it is like, well, what do you get from that? But it's almost a sort of meditative thing to do, and enjoying the process of doing it.
Yeah, and I think it also comes down to the relationships with the people around you. I think that anyone that chases, you know, something like an Olympic gold for 4, 8, 12 years. One, it's not a normal thing to do. So we must acknowledge that it's not normal. It's extremely different to what most people do. And when you come off that break, or you have a bit of an off season, it's really about managing those relationships, because it's literally like, if I'm away, even competing for a weekend or a week, or I'm on training camp, I come back a different person. I have to continually check in with myself, because you're so focused, especially at the Olympics, on this common goal of getting the best out of yourself, and then all these team members around you getting the best out of you. So it's almost like a microcosm. It's this small world that really doesn't exist, but it does. And everyone's asking how you are, what's your heart rate, what are you doing here? You know, how fast can you do this? What's your warm down strategy? And I'm like, okay. And then you suddenly get on a plane home and you're like, oh, I'm back in the normality. No one's asking how I am. No one's asking how I'm doing this. It's like, it's so bizarre. So I think, yes, off season, you do live this, you know, tedious kind of way of life, because it is tedious. It's boring. But at the same time, you get those massive highs in training when you break a result, or you get those massive highs in competition when you get exactly what you deserve. But at the same time, yeah, it's managing those relationships. And some people, you know, I've been there myself, where you're just like, okay, I've burned the candle here, you know, say in Rio or in Tokyo, I've burned it here as fast as I can. And did everything right, got the goal, but then I'm going to burn it over here because I deserve this because I've done all that. You know, it doesn't make sense. But I think as you get older, you do realize that, yes, the simple things are the best things, and having a slow transition back into normality, or slow transition, which is something I've got to look forward to in retirement one day, where I'm like, okay, I've done this for my whole life. I know nothing different. How do I change my routine? How do I acknowledge that, you know, I've got to kind of almost go back into, quote, the normal world?
But you too must have, or maybe you didn't, maybe it's the way I think, but you lead this sort of monastic life leading up to Olympics. Do you naturally go off the rails a bit? I mean, particularly when you're both younger, like at the start of it, did that happen for the two of you, that just, you know, there's a bit of partying and beers, you've not probably been drinking that much leading up to Olympics?
It did for me, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I definitely did, you know.
Because you guys, swimmers are much younger, and, you know, traditionally, if you look at the age group, the sort of demographic in an Olympic team, swimmers are quite a young team. And, you know, it traditionally as well, I don't know what it's like now, but swimming used to be at the front of the Olympic program. So you guys would finish quite early. So the swimmers, not just the British swimmers, but all the swimmers across the board, you would see them out celebrating, partying, having fun. And it was always a sort of jealousy of, oh God, I wish I was done. Look at these guys out, the pressure's off, they're having fun. But I think it is inevitable, isn't it, that at the end of 4 years of intense focus, whether it's been a successful Olympics or not, you just go out and let some steam off. And I think the Olympic Village is somewhere unlike anywhere else. It's like this place that all the journalists, all the media, they want to know what goes on behind those walls and these amazing parties and all that stuff. It's what usually happens is the athletes haven't drunk much alcohol for 4 years, so a couple of beers in, they're all over the place, and they're in bed by 11 because they can't handle it.
Yeah, it's definitely a weird place, really, the Olympic Village, because again, you've got all these athletes piled in together and very like different people, and on the kind of, you know, generalization that they all think they deserve to be there and win, which is exactly how you should be thinking. No one goes there and go, oh, I want to go and get bronze. You want to go there and give your best, get gold. So you've got all these people from different cultures, different places on the earth, and different qualifications, et cetera, different journeys. And some are there the first time, some are there for the fifth and beyond. Put all this together, you still create the same output of everyone's, you know, tried their best, and you still need, you know, to party and relax after. And I'm like, you know what, especially after Rio, because I was quite young, I was 21. I was like, I've just done some of the best swims of my life, broke world record in the heats, broke it again in the final. And then my first Olympic final, broke the world record. And then, you know, you're doing races against Michael Phelps in the relays and coming second behind him. And I'm like, you know what, this is so crazy, because you've thought about this moment all the time, but also there's nothing else to do. Once you finish competing, I'm like, what do you expect us to do? We're not just going to sit here and just continue training, because, you know, there's no reason to that. There's no point in that. So, yeah, of course, we've got a lot of stories that maybe one day I'll tell. But it's a lot of fun.
Trust me, Adam, there's no one listening here. You can just it's a very safe space. Who was the, you know, when you go to Olympic Village and you see some of the athletes around you, who was the one athlete that stood out that you were starstruck to be standing side by side, or that you saw in the village that you wanted to go and walk up to and speak to and get a selfie with, or just chat to?
I think, you know, I'm not sure if they had it in 2012 or before, but when they basically, in Team GB house, you have the medals. So they count the medals and put your name next to it. And I was the first one both times. So in Rio and Tokyo, I got the first gold medal. And that was crazy, because people would be coming up to you like, oh, well done, amazing swim. And I'd be like, wow, like, and then people coming up to you from all different sports that you've looked up over the years. But really, you know, seeing Michael Phelps on poolside, because not only is obviously, you know, he's an incredible swimmer, but he's one of the most successful Olympian of all time. And seeing him, he's like, oh, hey, dude, how are you? And stuff like that. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. And then you build, you know, you get to know him and you get to say hello and stuff. And then finally you're racing him. And he's like, once we raced in the medley relay in 2016, He was like, that was an absolutely crazy split, man. Like, he said that to me, obviously in an American accent. I don't want to butcher it, but...
go on, have a go.
He was, yeah, he's like, hey, man, that was an absolute crazy split. And I was like, yeah, I was like, wow, like, incredible from him to acknowledge that. And, you know, it becomes very, very surreal. But I'm not one of those people at the same time to... I don't think I've ever took a selfie in my life with someone like that, to be honest. Because I'm not like, I'm just not inclined that way. I just don't want to do it that way. And I'd rather have a conversation with them, if that makes sense. So
yeah,
it's, you get to see people from all angles and whatnot. But I feel you on that, when some people are finished competing, because even people finish before even swimming and have got what they want or haven't got what they want. It's just that unknown that is extremely, provoking.
What's the Olympic come down like? Because I was saying to Chris before, when I cover it, so I've done, you know, out there for a few weeks, it's crazy hours, you're doing all sorts of things. And even as a journalist, I feel like there's a come down. It must be even more pronounced as an athlete. How did you find it in Rio and Tokyo? And were they both different experiences, the aftermath? I mean, the weeks, whatever, afterwards?
Incredibly different. Paris, not Paris, we haven't done that yet, but the Rio experience, for example. One, because, you know, we were there for a week after, so we had other things to do. So we had almost like a decompression phase in the, you know, post-village or post-racing in the village, sorry. And then Tokyo, you were on the plane the next day home. And that was very, very weird because there was no kind of, no celebration with your teammates, firstly, because we were sent off. I had to do some sponsor stuff the night we finished racing or the afternoon we finished racing. So I didn't even get a chance to do that. And then I wanted to get home to, you know, George and my family, for example. So, yeah, I mean, Tokyo was just a very bizarre experience. Racing at Olympic Games with no crowd, firstly. But also just around the edges, everything was different with COVID. And I'm like, imagine if you tested positive on the morning of your final, for example. I'm like, living with that pressure, like, you pretty much just almost wasted that whole preparation. And it's something out of your control. So it's, yeah, very, 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 very different. But I mean, Rio had its, you know, Zika stuff, for example, the Zika virus. I remember the media were doing the circus around that. Who knows what's going to be in Paris? I'm sure we need to start making up something right now. It's just that fear thing around, you know, the whole games and whatnot. But it's, I think both experiences were just incredible because it went well. And, you know, athletes who didn't go well may have a different output on that. But at the same time, it's not about the outcome. It's about that preparation and that journey into it. And if you can enjoy the pain and the process, I think that'll teach you more about yourself and more about your life than a gold medal ever will.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
What was your impressions of, like, when you, so Rio, arriving at the village for the first time, that was your first Olympic experience, and arriving into that environment, what were your expectations, and what was the reality of living in the village?
I think, so we were based in Belo on our first camp, 2 weeks out. I think we flew out to Belo Horizonte, which is a 7 hour, 8 hour drive, but only an hour flight. So we're based there. And then on the last night before, it was like, oh, we're going to the village. We're going to need all your bags down at reception so we can get them overnight, down into the village. so they can end up in your room. So everything's done for you at the Olympic Games. You have to carry your bags and whatnot. And I got to my room the next day because we flew over. It said only carry your kind of cabin luggage. So I just packed my bag, put some spare race suits in there and trunks and whatnot just for redundancy. And then got to my room. I was like, where's my bags? And they're like, oh, everyone's going to try and find it. Everyone's scrambling. This is 3 days before I start competing. And my bags never showed up. So I had to borrow a little bit of kit, look out to my sponsors at the time to try and get me some race stuff. And they really just stripped back because I had nothing. And that was kind of the last hurdle into the village. I was like, you know what? I don't even care. I've been prepared in a way and a manner where I only need a pair of race trunks, a race hat and a pair of goggles. I don't need all this other fancy stuff to make to perform. And it really stripped me back because I think there were two options there where you could have gone, oh, this is rubbish. Who stole this? Using that energy on negative experiences or emotions. Or you can look on the bright side and go, well, someone's enjoying some nice Burberry out in Bellow. So it's probably still wearing my shades, to be honest. So, you know, I think that's what the British are good at. We've got, you know, very good humour and we can kind of laugh off that adversity. But at the same time, you know, the village had its problems, but it's also, you know, when you build a city in a sense, because that's what it is, it's not a village, it's a city. If you build it that quick for one purpose, of course there's going to be a few, you know, teething problems, but I never ever saw any of them as problems. I just like, okay, this is just a little hurdle we've got to get past and, you know, you just crack on because everyone's got to go through it. So it's always looking for those positivity cues as well.
And what's the atmosphere like? I mean, I did go to the village for a day just to have a little walk around in Rio to sort of sample it. And every what you notice is every Olympics, the atmosphere is slightly different. It has a unique spirit of that host nation. And also just the logistics of a village. Some are, you know, high-rise flats, some are little houses, you know, some are kind of halfway between the two. What was it like walking around? Were you really calm about it all, or were you having that sort of moment of, oh my God, I'm at the Olympics? I mean, I remember in Sydney feeling like just, I couldn't believe that was finally, you know, all my whole life I'd watched the Olympics and dreamed of going there. And when you finally get there, you know, like you were saying there, things can go wrong, you know, at any stage, injuries, you can get ill, things can happen last minute. But when you're finally there, you're checked into your room and you know that, yeah, this is actually happening and you're wandering about. Every bit of kit you've got has a little Olympic logo on it. And you think this is it, where it's about to happen. Were you calm? Was it just no bother, just another race? Or was this unique? Was it something special?
No, it was never just another race. This is personal to me because I might have invested in myself and the amount of, I hate the word sacrifice because it's a choice. You don't really sacrifice anything if you make that contract to yourself. But I remember, you know, the night before, bearing in mind, we got there 3 days before, all my stuff went missing. I was just finding my feet like you do. Okay, this is where that's at. That's what the food is over here. Just finding my bearings. Second day, you obviously warming up, getting used to it. And then the final night, because they close all the venues for the opening ceremony. So all the staff are at the opening ceremony. So we had to train kind of right last minute. I think it was like midday. And we had nothing to do for the rest of the evening. I haven't watched the opening ceremony from the TVs or at the Team GB house. And I was like really nervous at this point. I was like, shit, it's just hit me. I'm at the Olympic Games. And your mind almost goes into a little bit of a haywire. And it's like, almost starts to try panicking. And I was like, why am I feeling this? I've prepared for this. Okay, so I've acknowledged that I'm feeling a bit nervous. I feel a bit shaky. And I was like, right, I need to burn off some of this nervous energy. So I went down to the gym in the village, did a little like 10 to 15 minute circuit. And then it's automatic. Like my body just went into this like frenzy. I was like, right, let's get rid of this. Get the endorphins going. You're not nervous anymore. Had the best sleep of my life that so far. And woke up and I was like, right, let's go attack. So again, you've got to revert and not panic and revert to what you know. And I've known for at that point all my life was that exercise equals, you know, endorphins and it makes me feel good, makes me feel confident, but also will decrease all my anxieties, whatever they are. So I think every village, yes, as you say, has a different culture, different kind of vibe. Tokyo was very different because of all the COVID policies, people wearing masks, people not wearing masks, people double masking, washing our hands, not washing our hands. And yeah, just so many variables that could have gone wrong in Tokyo. But same in Rio. But that's life, you know. You could have 110% certainty on an investment, it still go wrong. So it's, again, just being a, we got to be real tough when that happens and, you know, crack on.
How are you, actually, this is probably a question for both of you, but Adam, how are you with, everyone expects you to win the whole time. And Chris, I think it was probably the same for you. Is that easy to take, or you just block it out, or what's the best way to deal with it?
I think you're never aligned to that. For me, I never aligned to that kind of full way of people expect you to win, because I'm like, it's just a strange thing to do, like, or strange thing to think of, because again, it's a sport where you're not relying on other people to do it for you either. You know, you haven't really got teammates. So if you're down on 90% or 85% one day when you wake up because of whatever's happened, that could potentially take you out of medals. It can take you out of gold, take you out of a world record. So again, there's so many variables, but also if you wake up at 105%, 110%, yes, you will get it. And that's exactly the same for you and your competition. So yeah, I mean, when I go in, I'm like, especially in Tokyo, because it was so bizarre, and that was a 5-year block of waiting for this moment to happen again. And so much had changed in that 5 years. I was barely the same person. And once I got it, I was like, I felt a huge relief. But it was never a certainty, because if you hit one stroke wrong, or hit a turn wrong, or you die in the last 15 meters, you know, it's all gone. People will expect you to win because all they see is, you did you get gold, or did you get silver or bronze, or were you in, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8? But again, you can't think about, there's no room in the mind to think about what other people expect. There's only room for what you can do, what you can achieve, and looking after your world anyway, you know. My family know how hard I've trained, how much I've put into this. My friends do. And, you know, the people who are close to me, and truly, are they the people that matter? Yes. You know, is someone shouting you in Twitter or X, whatever it's called now, saying, oh, you're a mug for coming forth. And I'm like, go on the profile, and they've got 10 followers, and they're absolutely screaming at everyone. And I'm like, you know what? I don't need to kind of validate my life through someone else that I don't know. So yeah, I mean, Chris may have a different approach to it, but I've always believed now, especially in the last year or so, that you got to look after your world and they'll look after you.
Yeah, I remember Sarah telling me that, you know, one of her friends before, I think it was a Kieran race at a World Cup or something in Manchester, right before the final, and they said to her, well, you must know he's going to win. I mean, he always wins. You must be relaxed. And she was like, you have no idea how nervous I am right now. And I guess, I mean, the Kieran was quite an unpredictable event, but yeah, I think people are mistaken when they see champions performing again and again, and they assume, yeah, but you must know you're going to win because you win consistently, so it must be routine, it must be easy. And, you know, I certainly, the pressure that I felt from external places, whether it's the general public or the media or whatever, it paled into insignificance compared to the pressure I put on myself. Like all the kind of the drive and the expectation was just from me. So, you know, every race I wanted to win. It didn't matter if it was a world champs or Olympics or a small race that was just there for a demo event or whatever. But yeah, you know, I don't know. I think expectation. Yeah, you try not to let it get to you. But I guess it's more about, like, from a cycling perspective, there's tactics involved. If the target's on your back, people are watching you in the race, they're reacting to you, and that can be a good thing because they're watching you, but they're waiting for you to make the move. So you have the chance to be the one that imposes your tactics in the race, and then they're all jumping on behind you trying to get a silver or a bronze. Whereas, I guess, in swimming, everybody's swimming their own race, they're in their own lane, they're trying not to react to you or look at you, you know, not be affected by you. But I was going to ask you, actually, we were discussing this before, Matt and I, Adam, we were saying, you know, in the early part of your career, it felt as though you were, you know, a Michael Johnson or Usain Bolt, somebody who had nobody really close enough to threaten you. And it was like, well, who's going to get second, third, fourth? There was never a question of who's going to win this race. What drives you on when you're in that phase of your career? And then when you start to have, you know, as you're saying now, for these games, there's a lot of challenge. There's other athletes coming in here. Does it help you to have a significant rival that you kind of pit yourself against and you can look forward to competing against? Or is it all just you focused on your own performance and everybody else is irrelevant?
I think, I wish I could have like a binary answer to quite a complex situation. I think when you're younger, that it's very easy to not even think about risk and just go for it because our brains are not fully developed in that manner. But when I was younger, yes, you know, you almost didn't have any competition, and every competition you went to, I had to almost lie to myself that I was going to get second to make sure that I was on full form and there was no complacency. And I managed that for a very long time. And then as you get older, you're like, okay, this is getting a little bit tougher now, not in terms of the competition, but in terms of the relationship with myself. Obviously with hindsight, that led to a burnout after I broke my foot in 2022. And, you know, missing various competitions because I just wasn't myself firstly, or my body wouldn't allow me to be there, or my mind. So it internally attacks you. So going into, you know, the Olympics now, yes, I do look forward to, given, you know, some of the people around me, my competition, a very, very hard and good race. How do I prepare for that? Do I imagine them and stick a poster up the wall? Absolutely not. Because it's just not unhealthy. It really isn't healthy, because what other manner would you do that? You know, would people in a quote normal job or a different job put a poster of the opposite company and start throwing darts at it or look at it every day and give themselves motivation? It may work for some people, and it may have worked for me when I was younger, but now I need peace. I need peace where I'm like, you know what? This is my belief system. My beliefs really come from the process that I execute every single day. And then emotionally, I don't even need to be there emotionally until 2 days, maybe a day before the Olympic Games. And it's the same with every competition I go in now. Whereas before, I was emotion first. That would give me my belief of, yeah, I am the best. Yeah, I am the best. That's my confidence. And I know you've been very public about working with various people in a psychological manner. But for me, with Stephen Peters, you know, he kind of corrects that in my mind, where my belief system, because I was like, sometimes you go into a meet and you're not, you know, Mel is my coach, for people who don't know that, but she absolutely batters me in training. So I'm like, I physically can't get any faster because my body is so battered. So going into a world championships, I only had a few days off hard work, going in off the hard gym. And I was like, I don't feel great, but I don't feel bad. So I'm in the middle line. Is that enough to win? Maybe, but maybe not. And I was like, I came back and I was like, Stephen, like, I don't really feel confident in what I'm doing. And I don't mind sharing this publicly at all. And I'm sure he won't mind as well. But I now understand that it's the other way around. You know, I don't need confidence. I just need belief in myself. And I've always had belief in myself, but it's a belief in the right moments, and the process will allow that. I've really gone away from that first question. Sorry.
No, I like it. We like tangents.
But it's very different.
Yeah. Steve's amazing. And yeah, for listeners that haven't heard of him, we have talked about him before on this podcast many times. But yeah, his ability to cut to the nub, to the important issue that is affecting your performance or stopping you achieving what you want to achieve, and help you to understand that, and also recognize when you're behaving that way, when your brain is starting to hijack your performance or getting in the way of what you can do. But yeah, the process versus outcome is it's the thing that was drilled into us. And certainly Steve was really the heart of that. And it becomes a bit of a cliche now. And all the athletes talk about the process now. You know, 10 years ago, it wasn't necessarily, you know, that common a thing. But it's the reason they talk about it is because it's true. And if, you know, you can't control what your rivals are going to do. You have no control over what, you know, you can't go into a race saying, I'm going to win a gold medal, because you don't know what they're going to bring. You could
put
substandard performance and win, or you could produce the best performance of your life and it will fall short of someone else's. So you can't say, I'm going to win this. You know, I'm definitely going to win it. So it has to be about the performance. And Steve was amazing at helping formulate a mental plan, a strategy, basically training your mind before you got to race day, so that you were ready for that whole potential last minute wobbles that, you know, your chimp, the emotional part of your brain would start trying to sort of rattle the cage and get a little bit stressed. But you have the answers for it. You've prepared for that. You know how you're going to react. You know how to respond with logic. And you go out there and try and just, as you say, perform, you know, produce the process and relax and almost enjoy it. And it's, I don't know, you know, you mentioned it there about the nerves of the anticipation before Rio, the night before. It's funny, I felt similar in London, although it was much closer to the race. I was still feeling like the pressure and the stress going into my final race. But once you get on the bike, once you start to actually do something physical, and you it's like pressing play on a, on a video or whatever. It's this routine, and your body takes over. It's automatic. You're on autopilot. You're in your comfort zone. You know what you're doing, and everything then starts to settle and flow. And the mind is an amazing thing. And yeah, Steve Peters is incredible because of how he can help you deal with some of the most stressful situations of your life. Certainly at that stage, you know, stepping up onto an Olympic final as the favourite, with the crowd cheering you on, knowing that, you know, this is your moment. If you get it right, this could be defining for your career. And if you get it wrong, that, you know, that moment has slipped from your grasp. But ultimately his input was to try and gain perspective and realize that you're just riding a bike in anti-clockwise circles or swimming up and down his pool or kicking a ball. It's, you know, this has to be fun. You have to enjoy it and realize that it's a snapshot in time. And if you don't enjoy it, you're going to regret it because not everybody gets this opportunity.
Mm. And I think also that one thing he's helped me with as well as, you know, various people that I've been with or their family and friends, and it's almost realizing that no one can ever take what you've done away from you. So I've done what I've done in my career, and I'm extremely proud and extremely happy to have done that. But it's also that I always used to live my life on, I'm only as good as my next race. And I'm like, is that really a healthy approach to what I do? And something so, so kind of simple, like again, like two lamps of the baths and making sure we don't get carried away. If it does go right or wrong, and still, you know, thinking that, you know, I do enjoy this. I do love getting up there. I do love preparing for that performance. And I love standing at, you know, in front of the world and going in lane four. Or on the blocks and just diving in and hearing that silence, but you can hear the roar above you. There's not many people on this planet will ever get to experience even 0.1%, if not lower than that. And I think it requires a certain mindset, but I'm also looking forward to the future after that and, you know, and not letting it define you.
You've had amazing success, but we need to talk about your sporting misadventures, the clues, obviously, and in the name of the podcast. So have there been moments of calamity, funny or otherwise, or have you been relatively scot-free in that regard?
Actually, when I was starting out, I've had a lot of things happen to me, but when I was racing at European Juniors, for context, this is my biggest race of my life so far. I prepared all season for this. I was like 17, I think it was at this point. And I get onto the blocks and I'm like, okay, my 50 meter went horrendous or my 200 meter went horrendous. I've got to win this race because there's two Brits who are qualified ahead of me. I've got to beat their time. At this point, you only can have two Brits in the final. So you've got to beat your own teammates to get that spot. I get on the block and I'm like, right, I'm ready. I'm physically primed, mentally primed to go and get it. And I stretch a little bit too far on the block. And bearing in mind, the crowd is behind me. My trunk was ripped right down the arse.
Oh no!
Like literally split from the middle. And I was like, why this happened? And secondly, like, what do I do about it?
What do I do?
Team manager comes down with this tiny pair of speeders that aren't even mine, that, like a training trunk, like a little G-string. And comes down, throws them and goes, put these on and you've got to race. And I guess that's my moment in my life where I'm like, nothing could have gone right that meet, but hey ho, that's life.
So did you put them on top or did you have to change into them?
Change into them in front whilst you're holding the race.
Oh my god.
So I was like, yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah,
straight in the deep end.
Oh god. Well, there was a bobsleigh
you've showed me this before.
Yeah, so Gillian, she was a Scottish bobsleigh athlete, and it was the same team that made the skin suits for the British cycling team back in the sort of early 2000s. Really, you know, top quality, you know, top people, you know, doing amazing stuff. But sadly for both the people that made the skin suit and for Gillian, just that moment where they sort of go back before they start to push, the same thing happened, and it was the cameras right behind her, and it's basically followed her through you know, she achieved World Cup success with her teammate and you know, did some amazing things, got the Olympics. But it seems to be the thing that she's most remembered for is this wardrobe malfunction.
Mm.
And I guess like swimming or cycling, you're not wearing much other than this millimeter of Lycra. And if it gives way, it's going to give way in a spectacular fashion.
Adam, yours wasn't on televised, was it, being that a junior event? Or did you escape without it being televised? And did you win the race, by the way, in your Speedos?
I think actually I might have won the heat. Because after that, I did a PB in that. I think the adrenaline from my body just was like, oh no, this is going extremely wrong. Just pump adrenaline in. So I actually did a PB, but I don't think it was enough to qualify. But at the same time, it is what it is.
The Speedo's not having, like, your trunk's not, there's no seam in them. So, I mean, that's quite a spectacular fail for it to give way.
Bonded, it's like a bonded, on the race trunks, it's like a bonded heated seam.
Okay.
So it's almost like a very thin, very thin seam. And this is a very long time ago with the older suits that people were wearing in 2012. So it's, I've not had it happen since. I've had it rip on the crotch, but you've got like another layer underneath. I've had it rip on the sides. But these suits are like, again, like space technology. It's crazy how like thin they are and whatnot. And if you stretch it a bit too far, very, very rare, very rare. But when you're wearing hundreds a year, of course, one's going to fail somewhere. So yeah, you're just trying to try not to happen at the Olympic Games, eh?
That must have been in your mind for races afterwards as you go back on the blocks. You just don't want to hear that tear behind you or whatever.
I guess so, yeah. But again, it's that thing where if you think of it too much, it's definitely going to happen. But I try not to speak it or think it into the universe.
And I can't remember when the suits were all changed. There was different, you know, for a while in the early 2000s, you had the full-armed, full-leg ones, and then they banned them and then they changed. Did you ever use any of the mega fast suits? What are they called? I can't remember, the shark suits or?
Yeah, the Faskins.
Faskins.
But that was, it was like a full body one where it basically would repel water so much that you could almost be very chubby and it would just carry you through the water. And people would like wear two or three at a time. So you'd almost create an air buoyancy between you and the other suit and the other suit. So you could almost not train and still be successful, which again goes against completely what it is. And they were banned in 2010, January. So I never really got a chance to wear them. Thankfully, I didn't. But because in 2009, there were so many world records broken at the World Champs in Rome that it was just getting ridiculous. And I think there's only a few world records left of those suits, very, very few now, because obviously training and mentality and physio, all these other things have caught up to the technology. But it's taken, you know, some of still haven't been broken, but it's taken a good 10 to 14 years for the human body to excel and keep up. It's crazy.
Would you never be tempted to get hold of one and have a shot and just for, I don't know, even just for social media, go out and crack, see what you can do for 100 meters and in a full suit?
Maybe. I'll have to reach out for that one. I think probably put one of your cycling suits on as well.
Yeah. Do you know what? At the time, for Sydney, it was the same suit they were making for the swimmers as for the because they weren't legal to cycle in, but they did make full length legs and arms for a Sydney suit, and then they had to chop them off at the knee for cycling. But they were, I think it was the same.
Wow.
It was Adidas were making them at the time, and that was when they had. Do you remember Kathy Freeman in the 400 meters with the hood? So she ran with a hood on and the full arms and full legs. It's crazy what they. And what was it for the decathlon or the heptathlon? Denise Lewis had that kind of one-armed thing when she was throwing the javelin. So the arm that was throwing the javelin didn't have, it had like a vest, but the other arm was full arm. And basically, I think they were all just
crazy.
Gather a bit of attention, but regulations change.
Yeah.
So apart from your suit splitting, I mean, it seems as though you've had a pretty blemish-free career. Then you've not had any other dramatic moments. Yeah. What about your teammates? There must have things happened within the team that are like, you know, folklore now, that they, you know, kind of amazing stories that have been passed down generation to generation. You must have a story.
I think I'd get sued the next day.
You can tell them.
I think it's like anything, you know, you have one equipment failure is the biggest one that happened. I think the British team now are pretty tame in a sense of our approach and what we do. And the culture, Australia, I'm actually sharing a room with an Aussie lad now, but they have, you know, so many things in the media that have gone wrong and things have been outed for, as we're all aware. But yeah, I think we're pretty tame. We like to have a laugh, but at the same time, it's, I actually can't share that much. I don't want to dig anyone out personally. But also the jokes that we do make are very inappropriate and very, I just got to say them. I can't say them, but it's also a very, very serious environment because we've all invested so much, all done all this stuff. But I do like a joke. I do like something to take the edge off because the Olympics and all these events that go around are just incredibly, incredibly difficult to deal with mentally, aren't they? So I'm just delaying my things I have to say now.
I was just thinking, suddenly it flooded back into my head. And maybe it was the Gold Coast Commonwealth Games, but was it Mike Bushell interviewing you and the other swimmers?
He's fallen in the water, yeah.
That was absolute cracker. Was that Gold Coast or maybe somewhere else?
That was Gold Coast, yeah, that was Gold Coast. Yeah, that was funny. That was very, very funny, bless him.
So he's not the tallest of guys. He's a wonderful guy, Mike. Have you met him before, Matt? I don't know.
Yes, I have.
So, yeah, I mean, he's not the tallest guy, is he? In this pool, it was quite deep, but what he didn't realise was just how deep it was. He assumed it was like the same depth the whole way across. And as he stepped across to interview, there was like you and about three or four of your teammates sitting on the edge of the pool with your feet dangling in the water, and he was going to walk along and stick the microphone in front of each of your faces and ask you a question each. And he just disappeared into the water.
Fully submerged, yeah.
Oh, my God, you guys were absolutely
Your expression is so good in the clip. I remember because you're not sure whether you're fully allowed to, I don't know, but you just sort of totally lose the plot.
I don't care where I was. There's no way you're not laughing at that. Absolutely no way.
Oh, fair, mate. He's great, though, and he does chuck himself in the deep end, no pun intended, at all the stuff that he goes for. I remember doing an event with Adam, Matt. We were in Glasgow. I think it was at the 20... Was it the European Championships in 2018? And we did a kind of an appearance in George Square. And there was something, I can't remember, it was like a mascot or something that sort of tickled us a little bit in terms of we just started to get the giggles. And we had to do like a photo call where we were on like a seesaw or something. But anyway, I've got this recollection of the two of us unable to hold it together. I'm not really sure what we were laughing at, but just absolutely cracking up like a couple of idiots who, and the more I looked at Adam, the more he made me laugh, and then vice versa. It was this kind of thing of, we need to hold this together. Come on, we're supposed to be mature, you know, adults here and doing this photo call, which was taking forever because we couldn't get ourselves together. But yeah, once you get the giggles,
you're gone.
Oh yeah, it's very hard, very, very hard.
Great. Well, I think that's it. I think you've taken up an hour. Are you training again this afternoon? Are you?
Yeah, in about 2 hours, I'll start walking up the hill again. Yeah, it's very hilly here. A lot of cyclists come here to train at the top of the volcano. I think they've got a hotel near there.
Yeah, you guys don't go for that kind of sleep high, train low thing. Is that there's
no,
never any altitude
here.
Training or no?
Just because of the output set for us is like VO2, so we want to make sure we have got oxygen to fuel the muscles for those sprints. So everyone has their own approach, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now these guys are the guys that do it are all, or 99% of them are all the kind of the tour riders, the mega endurance guys, not the sprinters. But we never bothered with altitude training. It was just keep it at sea level, sleep well, rest well, train hard.
Exactly. Nice and easy. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, listen, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time. And I hope that the rest of the camp goes well and that you're on good form coming into Paris. And we'll see you out there, hopefully.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Brilliant stuff. Thanks, Adam. Good luck with everything.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks,
bye. Bye. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.